Chapter 2. General Epanchin lived in a house of his own not far from Litany. Besides this magnificent house, 5/6 of its rooms were let in flats, he had another huge house in Sadovy Street, which was also a large source of revenue to him. He owned also a considerable and profitable estate close to Petersburg, and a factory of some sort in the district. In former days, the general, as everyone knew, had been a shareholder in government monopolies. Now he had shares and a considerable influence in the control of some well-established companies. He had the reputation of being a very busy man of large fortune and wide connections. In certain positions he knew how to make himself indispensable, for instance, in his own department of the government. Yet it was known that Ivan Fyodorovich Epanchin was a man of no education and the son of a simple soldier. The latter fact, of course, could only be to his credit. Yet though the general was an intelligent man, he was not free from some very pardonable little weaknesses, and disliked allusions to certain subjects. But he was unquestionably an intelligent and capable man. He made it a principle, for instance, not to put himself forward, to efface himself where necessary, and he was valued by many people just for his unpretentiousness, just because he always knew his place. But if only those who said this of him could have known what was passing sometimes in the soul of Ivan Fyodorovich, who knew his place so well. Though he really had practical knowledge and experience and some very remarkable abilities, he preferred to appear to be carrying out the ideas of others, rather than the promptings of his own intellect, to pose as a man disinterestedly devoted, and, to fall in with the spirit of the age, a warm-hearted Russian. There were some amusing stories told about him in this connection, but the general was never disconcerted by these stories. Besides, he was always successful, even at cards, and he played for very high stakes, and far from attempting to conceal this little, as he called it, weakness, which was pecuniarily and in other ways profitable to him, he intentionally made a display of it. He mixed in very varied society, though only, of course, with people of consequence. But he had everything before him. He had plenty of time for everything, and everything was bound to come in its due time. And in years, too, the general was what is called in the prime of life, 56, not more, and we know that that is the very flower of manhood, the age at which real life begins. His good health, his complexion, his sound, though black, teeth, his sturdy, solid figure, his preoccupied air at his office in the morning, and his good-humoured countenance in the evening at cards or at his graces, all contributed to his success in the present and in the future, and strewed his excellency's path with roses. The general had a family of blooming children. All was not roses there, indeed, but there was much on which His Excellency's fondest hopes and plans had long been earnestly and deeply concentrated. And, after all, what plans are graver and more sacred than a father's? What should a man cling to, if not to his family? The general's family consisted of a wife and 3 grown-up daughters. The general had married many years before, when only a lieutenant, a girl of almost his own age, who was not distinguished either by beauty or education, and with whom he had received only a dowry of 50 sols, which served, however, as a stepping-stone to his fortune in later days. But the general never in after years complained of his early marriage. He never regarded it as the error of his luckless youth, and he so respected his wife, and at times so feared her, indeed, that he positively loved her. His wife was a Princess Mushkin, of an ancient, though by no means brilliant, family, and she had a great opinion of herself on account of her birth. An influential person, one of those patrons whose patronage costs them nothing, had consented to interest himself in the young princess's marriage. He had opened a way for the young officer, and had given him a helping hand along it, though indeed no hand was needed. A glance was enough, and would not have been thrown away. With few exceptions, the husband and wife had spent their whole life in harmony together. At an early age, Madame Epanchin, as a princess by birth, the last of her family, possibly too through her personal qualities, had succeeded in finding influential friends in the highest circles. In later years, through her husband's wealth and consequence in the service, she began to feel almost at home in those exalted regions. It was during these years that the general's three daughters, Alexandra, Adelaida, and Aglaia, had grown up. They were only Epanchins, it's true, but of noble rank on their mother's side, with considerable dowries, and a father who was expected to rise to a very high position sooner or later, and what was also an important matter, they were all three remarkably good-looking, even the eldest, Alexandra, who was already turned 25. The second was 23, and the youngest, Aglaia, was only just 20. This youngest one was quite a beauty, and was beginning to attract much attention in society. But that was not everything. All three were distinguished by education, cleverness, and talent. Everyone knew that they were remarkably fond of one another, and always hung together. People even talked of sacrifices made by the two elder sisters for the sake of the youngest, who was the idol of the house. They were not fond of showing themselves off in society, and were modest to a fault. No one could reproach them with haughtiness or conceit, yet they were known to be proud and to understand their own value. The eldest was a musician, the second painted remarkably well. But this had not been generally known till lately, and had only come out accidentally. In a word, a great deal was said in praise of them. But there were hostile critics. People talked with horror of the number of books they had read. They were in no hurry to get married. They valued belonging to a certain circle in society, yet not to excess. This was the more remarkable, as everyone knew the attitude, the character, the aims and the desires of their father. It was about 11 o'clock when Mushkin rang at the general's flat, which was on the first floor, and was a modest one, considering his position. A liveried servant opened the door, and Mushkin had much ado to explain his appearance to the man, who, from the first, looked suspiciously at him and his bundle. At last, on his repeated and definite assertion that he really was Prince Mushkin, and that he absolutely must see the general on urgent business, the wandering servant conducted him into a little anteroom, leading to the waiting room that adjoined the general's study, and handed him over to another servant, whose duty it was to wait in the morning in the anteroom and to announce visitors to the general. This second servant, who wore a tailcoat, was a man over 40, with an anxious countenance. He was His Excellency's special attendant, who ushered visitors into the study and so knew his own importance. "Step into the waiting room and leave your bundle here," he said, seating himself in his armchair with deliberation and dignity, and looking with stern surprise at Mushkin, who had sat down on a chair beside him with his bundle in his hands.
"If you'll allow me," said Mushkin, "I'd rather wait here with you. What am I to do in there alone?"
You can't stay in the anteroom, for you are a visitor. In other words, a guest. Do you want to see the general himself?"
The servant obviously found it difficult to bring himself to admit such a visitor, and decided to question him once more.
"Yes, I have business," Mushkin began.
"I don't ask you what business. My duty is only to announce you. But I've told you already, without the secretary's leave, I'm not going to announce you."
The man's suspicion grew more and more marked. The prince was too unlike the ordinary run of visitors. Though at a certain hour the general used often, almost every day in fact, to receive visitors of the most varied description, especially on business, yet in spite of the latitude of his instructions, the attendant felt great hesitation. The secretary's opinion was essential before he showed him in.
"Are you really from abroad?" he asked, almost in spite of himself, and was confused. He had been about, perhaps, to ask, "Are you really Prince Mushkin?"
"Yes, I have only just come from the station. I think you were going to ask, am I really Prince Mushkin? But you didn't ask for politeness."
"Hm," grunted the astounded servant.
"I assure you that I haven't told you a lie, and you won't get into trouble on my account. And you need not be surprised at my looking like this and having a bundle. I am not in very flourishing circumstances just now."
"I have no apprehension on that score, you know. It's my duty to announce you, and the secretary will see you, unless you... That's just the difficulty. You are not asking the general for assistance, if I may make bold to inquire.
Oh, no. You can rest assured of that. My business is different.
You must excuse me, but I asked looking at you. Wait for the secretary. His Excellency is engaged with the Colonel at present, and then the secretary from the company is coming.
Then, if I have to wait a long while, I should like to ask you if there is anywhere I could smoke. I've got a pipe and tobacco.
Smoke? Repeated the attendant, glancing at him with scornful surprise, as though he could scarcely believe his ears.
Smoke? No, you can't smoke here. You ought to be ashamed to think of such a thing. It's a queer business.
Oh, I didn't mean in this room. I know that. I would have gone anywhere else you showed me, for I haven't had a smoke for 3 hours. I'm used to it, but it's as you please. There's a saying, you know, at Rome, one must...
Well, how am I going to announce a fellow like you? The attendant could not help muttering. In the first place, you have no business to be here. You ought to be sitting in the waiting room, for you are a visitor. In other words, a guest, and I shall be blamed for it. You're not thinking of staying with the family, he added, glancing once more at the bundle, which evidently disturbed him.
No, I don't think so. Even if they invite me, I shan't stay. I've simply come to make their acquaintance, that's all.
What? To make their acquaintance? The attendant repeated with amazement and redoubled suspiciousness. Why, you said at first you'd come on business.
Oh, it's hardly business. Though I have business, if you like, but only to ask advice. I've come chiefly to introduce myself, because I am Prince Mushkin, and Madame Epanchin is a Princess Mushkin, the last of them, and there are no Mushkins left but she and I.
Then you are a relation?
The startled lackey was positively alarmed.
Hardly that, either. Still, to stretch a point, I am a relation, but so distant that it's not worth counting. I wrote to Madame Epanchin from abroad, but she didn't answer me. Yet I thought I must make her acquaintance on my return. I tell you all this, that you may have no doubt about me, for I see you are still uneasy. Announce Prince Mushkin, and the name itself will be a sufficient reason for my visit. If I am received, well and good. If not, it's perhaps just as well. But I don't think they can refuse to see me. Madame Epanchin will surely want to see the last representative of the elder branch of her family. She thinks a great deal of her family, as I have heard on good authority.
The prince's conversation seemed simple enough, yet its very simplicity only made it more inappropriate in the present case, and the experienced attendant could not but feel that what was perfectly suitable from man to man was utterly unsuitable from a visitor to a manservant. And since servants are far more intelligent than their masters usually suppose, it struck the man that there were two explanations. Either the prince was some sort of impostor who had come to beg of the general, or he was simply a little bit soft and had no sense of dignity, for a prince with his wits about him and a sense of his own dignity would not sit in an anteroom and talk to a servant about his affairs. So in either case, he might get into trouble over him.
"Anyway, it would be better if you'd walk into the waiting room," he observed as impressively as possible.
"But if I had been there, I wouldn't have explained it all to you," said Mishkin, laughing good-humouredly. "And you would still have been anxious, looking at my cloak and bundle. Now, perhaps, you needn't wait for the secretary, but can go and announce me to the general."
"I can't announce a visitor like you without the secretary. Besides, His Excellency gave special orders just now that he was not to be disturbed for anyone while he is with the Colonel. Gavril Ardalionovitch goes in without being announced."
"An official?"
"Gavril Ardalionovitch? No, he is in the service of the company. You might put your bundle here."
"I was meaning to, if I may. And I think I'll take off my cloak, too."
"Of course. You couldn't go in your cloak."
Mishkin stood up and hurriedly took off his cloak, remaining in a fairly decent, well-cut, though worn, short jacket. A steel chain was visible on his waistcoat, and on the chain was a silver Geneva watch. Though the prince was a bit soft, and the footman had made up his mind that he was so, yet he felt it unseemly to keep up a conversation with a visitor. Moreover, he could not help feeling a sort of liking for the prince, though from another point of view he aroused in him a feeling of strong and coarse indignation.
"And Madame Epanchin, when does she see visitors?
asked Mushkin, sitting down again in the same place.
"That's not my business. She sees visitors at different times, according to who they are. The dressmaker is admitted at 11, even. Gavriil Ardalionovitch is admitted earlier than other people, even to early lunch."
"Your rooms here are kept warmer than abroad," observed Mushkin. "But it's warmer out of doors there than here. A Russian who is not used to it can hardly live in their houses in the winter."
"Don't they heat them?"
"No, and the houses are differently built. That is to say, the stoves and windows are different."
"Have you been away long?"
4 years, but I was almost all the time at the same place in the country."
"You've grown strange to our ways."
"Yes, that's true. Would you believe it? I'm surprised to find I haven't forgotten how to speak Russian. As I talk to you, I keep thinking, why, I am speaking Russian nicely. Perhaps that's why I talk so much. Ever since yesterday, I keep longing to talk Russian."
"Used you to live in Petersburg?"
In spite of his efforts, the lackey could not resist being drawn into such a polite and affable conversation.
"In Petersburg? I've scarcely been there at all, only on my way to other places. I knew nothing of the town before, and now I hear there's so much new in it that anyone who knew it would have to get to know it afresh. People talk a great deal about the new courts of justice now."
"Courts of justice. It's true there are courts of justice. And how is it abroad? Are their courts better than ours?"
"I don't know. I've heard a great deal that's good about ours. We've no capital punishment, you know."
"Why? Do they execute people there, then?"
"Yes. I saw it in France, at Lyon. Dr. Schneider took me with him."
"Do they hang them?"
"No, in France they always cut off their heads."
"Do they scream?"
"How could they? It's done in an instant. They make the man lie down, and then a great knife is brought down by a heavy, powerful machine called the guillotine. The head falls off before one has time to wink. The preparations are horrible. When they read the sentence, get the man ready, bind him, lead him to the scaffold, that's what's awful. Crowds assemble, even women, though they don't like women to look on."
"Well, it's not a thing for them."
"Of course not, of course not. Such a horrible thing. The criminal was an intelligent, middle-aged man, strong and courageous, called Le Gros. But I assure you, though you may not believe me, when he mounted the scaffold he was weeping and was as white as paper. Isn't it incredible? Isn't it awful? Who cries for fear? I'd no idea that a grown man, not a child, a man who never cried, a man of 45, could cry for fear. What must be passing in the soul at such a moment? To what anguish it must be brought. It's an outrage on the soul. That's what it is. It is written, 'Thou shalt not kill.' So because he is killed, are we to kill him? No, that's impossible. It's a month since I saw that, but I seem to see it before my eyes still. I've dreamt of it half a dozen times."
Mushkin was quite moved as he spoke. A faint colour came into his pale face, though his voice was still gentle. The footman followed him with sympathetic interest, so that he seemed sorry for him to stop. He, too, was perhaps a man of imagination and strainings after thought.
"It's a good thing, at least, that there is not much pain," he observed, "when the head falls off."
"Do you know," Mushkin answered warmly, "you've just made that observation, and everyone says the same, and the guillotine was invented with that object. But the idea occurred to me at the time that perhaps it made it worse. That will seem to you an absurd and wild idea, but if one has some imagination, one may suppose even that. Think. If there were torture, for instance, there would be suffering and wounds, bodily agony, and so all that would distract the mind from spiritual suffering, so that one would only be tortured by wounds till one died. But the chief and worst pain may not be in the bodily suffering, but in one's knowing for certain that in an hour, and then in 10 minutes, and then in half a minute, and then now, at the very moment the soul will leave the body, and that one will cease to be a man, and that that's bound to happen. The worst part of it is that it's certain. When you lay your head down under the knife and hear the knife slide over your head, that quarter of a second is the most terrible of all. You know, this is not only my fancy. Many people have said the same. I believe that so thoroughly that I'll tell you what I think. To kill for murder is a punishment incomparably worse than the crime itself. Murder by legal sentence is immeasurably more terrible than murder by brigands. Anyone murdered by brigands, whose throat is cut at night in a wood, or something of that sort, must surely hope to escape till the very last minute. There have been instances when a man has still hoped for escape, running or begging for mercy after his throat was cut. But in the other case, all that last hope, which makes dying 10 times as easy, is taken away for certain. There is the sentence, and the whole awful torture lies in the fact that there is certainly no escape, and there is no torture in the world more terrible. You may lead a soldier out, and set him facing the cannon in battle, and fire at him, and he'll still hope. But read a sentence of certain death over that same soldier, and he will go out of his mind or burst into tears. Who can tell whether human nature is able to bear this without madness? Why this hideous, useless, unnecessary outrage? Perhaps there is some man who has been sentenced to death, been exposed to this torture, and has then been told, "You can go. You are pardoned." Perhaps such a man could tell us. It was of this torture and of this agony that Christ spoke too. No, you can't treat a man like that. Though the footman would not have been able to express himself like Mushkin, he understood most, if not all, of the speech. That was evident from the softened expression of his face.
"If you are so desirous of smoking," he observed, "you might be able to, perhaps, only you would have to make haste about it. For His Excellency might ask for you all of a sudden, and you wouldn't be here. You see the door under the stairs? Go in there, and there's a little room on the right. You can smoke there, only you must open the window, for it's against the rules."
But Mushkin had not time to go and smoke. A young man with papers in his hands suddenly appeared in the anteroom. The footman began helping him off with his coat. The young man looked askance at Mushkin.
"This gentleman, Gavril Ardalionovitch," the footman began confidentially and almost familiarly, "announces himself as Prince Mushkin, and a relation of the mistress. He has just arrived from abroad with the bundle in his hand, only..."
Mushkin could not catch the rest. As the footman began to whisper, Gavril Ardalionovitch listened attentively and looked with great interest at the prince. He ceased listening at last and approached him impatiently.
"You are Prince Mushkin?" he asked with extreme politeness and cordiality.
He was a very good-looking, well-built young man, also about 28, of medium height with fair hair, a small Napoleonic beard, and a clever and very handsome face. Only his smile, with all its affability, was a trifle too subtle. It displayed teeth too pearl-like and even. In spite of his gaiety and apparent good nature, there was something too intent and searching in his eyes.
"He must look quite different when he is alone, and perhaps he never laughs at all," was what Mushkin felt.
The prince briefly explained all he could, saying almost the same as he had to the footman, and before that to Rogozhin. Meanwhile, Gavril Ardalionovitch seemed recalling something.
"Was it you," he asked, "who sent a letter to Lizaveta Prokofievna a year ago, or even less, from Switzerland, I think?"
Yes.
"Then they know about you here, and will certainly remember you. You want to see His Excellency? I'll announce you at once. He will be at liberty directly. Only you ought... you had better step into the waiting room.
Why is the gentleman here?" he asked the servant sternly.
"Oh, I tell you, he wouldn't himself..."
At that moment the door from the study was thrown open, and a military man with a portfolio in his hand bowed himself out, talking loudly.
"You are there, Gania!" cried a voice from the study. "Come here!"
Gavril Ardalionovitch nodded to Mishkin and went hastily into the study. 2 minutes later the door was opened again, and the musical and affable voice of Gavril Ardalionovitch was heard.
"Prince, please come in."